Hello, hello. Welcome to episode 180 of the Fitness Simplified podcast. I'm your host, Kim Schlag. On today's episode, I am joined by the amazing Steph Gaudreau. Steph is a performance nutrition and strength coach who helps women athletes over 40 fuel, train, and recover smarter. That's what we're going to be talking about today. We talk about fueling your training, how to support your lifting with your nutrition. We get into nutrient timing for your workouts. We talk about supplements, creatine, protein powder. What do you need to know about those things? Are they things you should be using? And if so, how? We also talk about lifting heavy. What does that even mean? What does that look like? How do you do it? And if you're somebody who has not quite gotten into barbell training yet and you're kind of interested, like how could you make that transition maybe from like group training or using machines or using dumbbells to training with a barbell? What's a good path to do that? We talk through that today on this episode. Before we jump into the episode, quick reminder, next month, I can't believe it's here already, I'm opening the doors to Fitter After 40. Now, this is my signature program. I've coached hundreds of women through Fitter After 40. They've lost pounds, they've lost inches, they've gained strength and peace of mind with this 8-week course called Fitter After 40. I show you exactly how to eat and how to move for incredible results. Doors are opening Thursday, August 24th. You can get on the wait list right now, which you definitely want to do if you think you're interested, because if you join from the wait list, you get a discount and some exclusive bonuses. So I'm going to put the link in the show notes. Get on it now. You can find out all kinds of information about Fitter After 40 at the link in the show notes. Okay, on to the show. Hi, Steph. Welcome to Fitness Simplified.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm thrilled to have you here. So I don't know if you remember, but we first met, it was like 2016. JVB, who I don't even think does much like online fitness stuff anymore. Like I don't see her anymore. She was running a powerlifting course. It was this online powerlifting group, which was actually really a life-changing moment for me. Like that course literally changed. It changed my life. I had never heard of powerlifting before. I had entered the fitness industry after being obese through the bodybuilding kind of world. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that there was really any other part of the fitness world. And I was literally getting ready to hire a bodybuilding coach because I was like, I guess that's the next thing I do here. Like this, what seems like I do. And I've had all this like inner turmoil because it didn't feel really in alignment. Like I felt like I'd been getting healthier. And I felt like making this decision was going to kind of start heading me. Not that bodybuilding is inherently unhealthy. It just can be that way. Anyway, and that's when I found this powerlifting program and learned what powerlifting was. And in that program, towards the end of it, when a lot of us were signing up for our very first powerlifting meets, JVB had you come on and do a call with us all about nutrition and fueling ourselves for the meet. And that is how I was first introduced to you.
I know. It's amazing how quickly the time goes by. And I'll say, I think for all the dark sides of the internet and social media, there are also amazing opportunities for connection. You know, people you would never meet in real life, like you live very far apart or you're just parts of different circles, even though you're doing similar things. So, you know, I always try to remember that there's a positive side to it. And when I hear those kinds of stories, it's cool. It's cool to see that like that connection was made way back then.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I know it's easy to get down on social media because we can so easily see the bad side of it. And specifically when we're talking about like women and fitness, there is so much out there that's just BS that leads women to think, one, that we're frail, that we have to be just a lot of nutrition information that actually leads to a bad place, not a good place, information about fitness that is wrong, that leads women to not push themselves in a way that they could actually find great satisfaction doing. And those are some of the kind of things I want us to talk about today. We're going to talk about lifting. We're going to talk about fueling our lifting. And I'm really excited to talk with you specifically about these. So let's kind of start with this idea of lifting heavy, right? We all talk about this a lot. Well, not all of us, but a lot of us as women in the fitness industry really promote this idea of lifting heavy. And I think that there's not necessarily a connection with the lay public about what that actually means and what that looks like in practice. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe the general public has seen I don't know, a story on TV or in the paper or their favorite news site of maybe like Eddie Hall deadlifting 1,000 pounds and thinking that that's lifting heavy. And wow, that actually looked really scary. Or they've seen strongman maybe on TV, or, you know, you see kind of these exhibitions or people that are at the extreme end of what heavy lifting is. And that turns a lot of people off, quite frankly, because it looks like inherently dangerous, or those people don't, you don't see yourself in them. So you think I could never do something like that. Or we just have a very simplified way of looking at it. And I think social media, you know, to kind of go back to that and how we communicate things, we rely on general terms or heuristics, if you will, to help communicate complicated concepts in a very nice, neat little package.
Yeah.
So we'll say something like lift heavy, and as people in the industry who have, you know, done this personally and professionally, we know that there's a lot of nuance to what that means. So I think the challenge is in communicating to the general public what some of that nuance is. And let me tell you what, nuance is not like hot takes on social. Nuance is not like what sounds trendy and, you know, like it's going to give you a quick result or something like that. Like it takes time to sit through it, to talk through it, to understand the finer points, the gray areas, and then how it's applied to a particular person. So I think when we say lifting heavy, we just mean lifting a challenging enough weight for you such that like you could maybe only do 2 or 3 more reps with decent technique, mm-hmm. sound technique. And again, I think sometimes people think, well, it has to look perfect. And they have an idea in their mind of like what a correct squat looks like, knowing that there's nuance there too. We all have different body proportions. There's different kinds of squats that work for different people better. You know, your squat that's really solid might look different from my squat that's really solid. And it doesn't mean that because yours doesn't look like mine, that you're inherently going to hurt yourself. Like, so there's a lot of detail to talk through here. And I think that when we get into chatting with the general public, like we have to overcome a lot of those generalities, but also the stereotypes and the perceptions, like, you know, or the misinformation, like lifting heavy is going to make you get hurt, or we shouldn't lift heavy if we're over 40, or some of these different things, or, you know, in order to, if you want to lift heavy, like you should have this particular look. And I think that stuff has to be broken down slowly over time. Like we have to continue educating, we have to continue explaining what we mean by certain things rather than just defaulting to things like the hot takes, mm-hmm. which do get shared more on social media. They are more shareable. They are more, you know, everybody loves controversy. The algorithm loves controversy. So I think that there's just a continued need to show up and talk through what it means and hopefully ultimately help people get into the gym and explore those things for themselves, but with that background of evidence-based, you know, information, you know, looking at those evidence-based practices, they're learning it from good quality sources, and then going through the process of continuing to show up, knowing that this is going to take time. And what's heavy for you is going to evolve as you go.
Absolutely. That it's relative to you. Lifting heavy is always relative to you. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about the value of it. Now we kind of have a little bit, greater shared understanding with the audience of what lifting heavy is, that it's relative to you. Talk about why it's important anyway.
Yeah. So I think the first thing we might want to say just for context is we used to think that there were very discrete like rep ranges for built for certain kinds of like muscle stimulus or certain kinds of muscular outcomes. So strength versus hypertrophy or growing your muscle versus something like muscular endurance. We used to think that those were very set in stone, very clearly defined, and newer research seems to indicate, you know, there's more of a range here. There's more overlap. It's a little bit more flexible. So I think when we're thinking about strength training in specific, we're talking about moving heavier loads for generally fewer repetitions. Mm-hmm. And that has a few benefits. I mean, when we are able to engage more of our musculature because we're pushing against a heavier weight, that just means we're using more muscle fiber. And it also makes it more likely that we're engaging, especially if we're doing things that are a little bit more explosive, we're engaging those muscle fibers that are necessary for us to be able to move quickly. So, you know, if we think about like power, plyometric, or even just a really heavy single or a really heavy double, we're really recruiting all of our muscle fiber. So that's super important as we're aging to maintain that functionality and prevent the sort of metabolic shifting of muscle fiber from some of that type two more explosive fiber to the type one slower, you know, people call this like fast twitch, slow twitch, but that slower muscle fiber. And people think, well, you know, maybe I'm not going to do a sport where I'm jumping around a lot, or I don't know, I'm trying to like sprint or something like that, which actually those things are kind of important that we're able to maintain. But when we're talking about being able to harness that power, like the ability to move quickly, that does have an outcome in terms of our quality of life. Like if you trip and you start to lose your balance, how you're going to start catching yourself is by engaging like those fast twitch fibers. So it really does come down to a quality of life issues. You know, if we're able to push more weight in terms of lifting heavy strength training, then we're also going to have that effect of bone building. And that's really important as well. So sometimes people will only hear about plyometrics, or they only think about impact training, like running, as having an effect on bone building. But actually what we're seeing is if we're able to, you know, when we lift weights, we're pulling, you know, we have muscle that's attached to bone via tendon. We're pulling on those bones. And particularly if we're involving all planes of movement as much as we can in our training, we're going to add to that. So we have that bone building effect, right? We're engaging our muscle fibers. We're maintaining that pool of muscle mass, which is important for things like blood sugar regulation. And it becomes insofar as becoming a sink for storing sugar in the body, storing glycogen. So, you know, we have better insulin sensitivity when we do strength training. You know, there's so many benefits to it that go beyond just like looking a particular way, or coming to an aesthetic outcome. There's some really interesting meta-analyses about the effect of resistance training and impacts on things like anxiety and mild depression. Yeah, mood, like self-efficacy, again, just quality of life overall. Like it's so important to be able to do those things. And I think to recontextualize them as we age and like our priorities start shifting as well.
Yeah, there's such a huge array of benefits to strength training. And look, ladies listening, if you're like, oh, like I just wanted to have some toned arms, there's nothing wrong with that. You can still achieve that. But looking at the overall quality of life, your health, as you were saying, like the mental health benefits, the array of benefits is just so huge and there for the taking. And I find that focusing on those benefits doesn't mean you're still not going to get the aesthetic benefits. It can just feel so much more empowering when you're focusing on these other benefits, and you can still have the aesthetic piece as well if that's important to you.
Yeah. Can I say something on that? I think it's really important.
Absolutely.
A lot of people come to exercise for extrinsic reasons, like they have extrinsic motivators and things that they want to, you know, oftentimes like do this particular thing to achieve a specific look for really the pleasing of someone else, or to meet societal norms, or to try to fit into like a particular, I don't know, aesthetic standard. And so oftentimes people can come into fitness and lifting maybe even, and that's like that's really motivating at first for people. But we know through mindset research and looking at how the long-term, like what is our ability to long-term show up for things like exercise and fitness, it really does come down to how are we able to over time connect with more intrinsic motivators? Or if we do still have because like, let's face it, some people are really motivated by like finishing a race or something like that. That's it's still a little bit more on the extrinsic side, because that's a spectrum. It's like, how do we identify that with our values? Like, how do we connect with our values or our identity? Or over time, how do we shift and connect to something that's more intrinsically motivated? So that's really, really critical, I think, if we're going to be in fitness for the long term, is we might come in because we have an extrinsic reason that's very much outside of ourselves. But if we're going to keep showing up for it in the long term, is really looking, pushing ourselves to find, connect with things that are more intrinsic, things that are more aligned to our identities or our values.
Yeah.
And framing fitness in that way.
And I know for me, what that is I want to be able to be an independent woman as I age. I've seen too many people who, you know, they can't go to the grocery store themselves. They can't even open a cupboard and get something from a high shelf for themselves in their 70s and their 80s and beyond. Heck, in their 60s, I've seen women like this. You know, I want to be able to get down on my knees and pick something up and stand back up. And I want to be able to be actively engaged in being outside when I'm older. And I know that in order to do that, what I do now is critical. And it has nothing to do with like how I want my abs to look or how I want my arms to look, which used to be super important to me. And that has just taken such a backseat when I think about really what is important to my overall happiness now and in the years to come.
Yeah, totally agree.
So a lot of women enter kind of the fitness space, their workouts through either something like a group fitness class or like some kind of, it used to be like DVDs and VHS, but now I'm guessing yeah. It's more like I'm aging myself there. That's how I did. Like I came in like watching like literally like Richard Simmons and like step aerobics. Like that's how I kind of found my first steps in fitness. And it can be really intimidating to a woman to think of going from one of those types of things, like I'm doing something on Fitness Blender, or I'm doing this old, you know, DVD I had, or I'm in this group class, to actually thinking like, I know what to do with a barbell. Mm-hmm. What would you say, like, what's a path that a woman could take from I'm in a fitness class or watching this DVD, this Fitness Blender, to I know what to do with a barbell?
I love this question. And it's one that I hear all the time, and I'm right there with you. I was doing Denise Austin, you know, in my living room in the morning when I was in college, and I was doing the Firm and like all these, you
know, buns, did the Firm,
Buns of Steel, like buns all that steel. Stuff.
Tammy Lee Webb.
Yeah. So I'm right there with you. And I think, it's generally quite different. And this is probably, you know, a bit of a generalization, but I would say like, it's more likely that a guy maybe lifted weights with his dad or his uncle or his brother in the garage, or did strength training as part of maybe a high school sport. Like obviously in more recent years, I think some of that's shifting, but you're right. There is oftentimes that gap between being able to kind of go off on your own and do things and feel really confident. And yes, to your point, doing heavier lifting, that's going to be a little bit more involved than just say some dumbbell work. Although you can get a great workout from just dumbbells. So I'm not, you know, dissing that in any way, but it is a bit of a leap to understand like, well, how do I use this equipment safely? How do I, do this in a way where, again, I'm moving with like sound technique and things like that. So the first, suggestion I'm going to say is getting in there and working with a coach or a trainer, if you can. I know that's not always possible because of resources and availability and things like that. But even if you could do, I would say like 2 to 3 months learning from someone in person, it is so much easier to spot, you know, things in your form that need to come up, to teach you how to use the equipment properly, like stuff we take for granted. Like say, for example, I want to do a bench press, like a barbell bench press, like how high should I set the bar? Like, how do I do it safely? What's the purpose of safety bars? Like if I don't have safety bars, like should I use clips on this bar or not? So there's a lot that goes into sort of even being able to do those things with confidence. So if you can get in and work with someone in person, I always say like, to me, that's going to be the best option of getting you up to speed as quickly as possible and helping you really feel like you are in you're in capable hands and you're going to be able to then go and execute this on your own. Even simple things like one of my virtual clients right now was sending me a video of herself deadlifting. And I was like, has anybody ever taught you how to pull the slack out of the bar? And she was like, nope. So I was able to kind of, you know, record a video of like, this is what pulling the slack out is, and this is why it's important. But little things like that are really easy to miss. So that kind of goes into my second pathway, which would be working with somebody virtually. I don't think it's exactly the same, but if you can have, you know, for example, a barbell training program where you have access to a coach and that coach is able to, you know, give you feedback, you're able to like record videos and send those, like I did with my client. And I was like, hey, you're not pulling the slack out of the bar. No wonder it feels weird off the floor, especially as it's getting heavier. I think that's the next best option. Mm-hmm. And then when you're really experienced, go off on your own, you know? But I think in helping you to gain the proficiency with the movements, spot changes in the technique that could really help you and making that lift feel much smoother, helping you feel confident, helping to use the equipment and understand, like, you know, even basic safety, like how do I fail a lift properly?
Yeah, that's important.
Right. And I think there's that hesitancy of like, I don't know, I'm afraid to get pinned under this bar. Or what if I fail a squat in the bottom? What do I do? And so sometimes we tend to just say, you know what, that's just not for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
practicing failing is super key. It's one of the things I have all of my clients do as they learn a certain lift. I show them, I'm like, this is how you fail. You're going to feel super. And I remember I was really hesitant when I was barbell back squatting. I was always super nervous about failing until my coach one time, he's like, I want you to fail a bunch today. He's like, just purposely, I want you to get down to the bottom. And he's like, at first, just pretend you can't get up. He's like, don't actually load the bar up. He's like, I want you to pretend you can't get up. What will you do? He's like, go through the steps. And after I did it a bunch, I'm like, this is literally not scary at all. I'm just down here. I have the safety arms set correctly. The bar was empty, but I would get down to the bottom and I would pretend I couldn't get back up. I would literally leave the bar there and stand up. And after I did it a bunch of times, I was like, all right, like that was not so scary. Same thing with a barbell bench. I will tell you to this day, because I do all my lifting in my basement alone. And so literally every time I barbell bench, I set up my safety arms and I practice with an empty bar and I make sure like that I put the bar that I can put the bar down. And if I need to just, you know, get off that bench, because then I can feel like if I do fail, it's no problem. And so I literally, as part of my warmups, I make sure that they're set correctly, because then that fear is not there. The time you're actually most likely to get hurt when you're training is when you're worried about getting hurt. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're like not, if you're feeling really hesitant about these things, so you want to feel confident. I love the suggestion to try and work with somebody in person. For some people, like you said, it just doesn't work. The only person I ever trained in person with was my friend who taught me to lift. It was just this guy who was he was staying at our house and I was trying to keep him out of trouble. And he's the one who taught me how to lift. He was just this 19-year-old kid. I was a 43-year-old woman and he taught me how to lift in the gym. He was my workout buddy for 3 months because I was trying to keep him out of trouble. And other than that, all my coaches have been online. Mm-hmm. It was definitely important that they were available to look at form feedback. So I wasn't just lifting blind and sending things in. You know, I would send them videos from the side so they could see what I was doing. They would give me feedback. And then I would really practice these skills. And so I do think having a coach to do that with, and then even filming yourself, you can learn so much filming yourself and watching it in between sets. You can kind of get these, like the nuances of all these things. And it's a really important thing to remember that these bigger lifts, you know, bench press, back squat, deadlift, there are so many factors that you're going to need to work on. You're not going to get it all right. Even I was months and months into training before I felt like I was nailing each of these things that was really making it a great lift. Like that I was being really technically good at each of these lifts. So filming yourself is really important. I do think one of the easiest lifts, if you're like, I don't really have the money for a coach, one of the easiest barbell moves to learn is a Romanian deadlift. Because if you know how to do a Romanian deadlift with dumbbells, there's literally no difference except for you're going to walk up to the rack and take the barbell off the rack versus the dumbbell. So I do think that's a great move to start with if you're like, I just want to get my hands on a barbell and I can't afford a coach yet.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, any kind of like, because the Romanian deadlift is going to be a lower load movement, right? Compared to like a conventional, or even something like a hex bar. I think that's a great one. And it's also such a great like accessory movement for building strength. And it is a good transition over, you know, to your point about filming yourself. I mean, I film myself all the time and I post my videos obviously quite a bit, but I also do it for myself. And so yesterday I was deadlifting and I could tell that on my heaviest set, which was a single, when I pulled the bar, I could tell like something just felt like it wasn't 100% dialed in for me. So when I went back and looked at it, I could see, you know what? I got a little excited when I did my dynamic start and I I like extended my, you know, my knees and kind of like came up to get tension in my hamstrings, and I do more of a dynamic start and dropped my hips back down. And I was just a little bit low when I dropped my hips back down. So what I had to do was actually raise my hip a tiny bit and then pull, you know, finish the rest of the pull. So that was a very smooth movement. The lift felt good, but you know, it's little stuff like that, that you can pick up on. I also then went to do a heavy overhead press single, and I haven't failed a lift in a long time. And I was like, yeah, okay. Like that one definitely got my attention. I failed the lift. And I was like, you know, again, I'm pretty sure I didn't get the bar back quick enough. You know, I just had a little bit of like straight or almost a little bit forward press off the shoulders. And, you know, at that heavy percentage, that heavy load, like your tolerance for mistakes and that kind of stuff is going to be a lot less. So yeah, filming yourself is so important. Mm-hmm. And I just hear from so many people that are not comfortable, like looking at themselves either in pictures or on video. Maybe they're dealing with some body image challenges and they're like, oh, but I don't want to look at myself. And I understand that. And I'm not saying that that's an easy thing, but I think that there's so much that you can learn from doing that and kind of going through it as an educational process.
Yeah. And I think it can actually even help with that stuff. I think like learning to look at yourself for skill, like what you're doing versus like, where is this roll of fat or how is that looking, right? Like instead of looking for that aesthetic piece, like you're watching yourself, you're looking yourself, not about your outfit, but literally about how you're performing something and you're noting the things you're improving and the things that you want to work on. I think it can really help with this whole, like, I don't like to look at myself, because you're mm-hmm. seeing yourself in a different light. You're seeing yourself as a person who is accomplishing something, as a person who is doing, is acting, not just a person who's like there to be looked at.
Yeah. 100%.
And I also think it, like when we're training, especially, you know, a lot of times when people enter the fitness space and they're used to classes and they're used to these like workouts where you just switch stuff up all the time, doing progressive overload type strength training, when you're doing the same lifts over and over, it can feel a little bit boring for people. And I think videoing yourself and really looking to fine tune things can be one of the things that can help keep it spicy, because mm-hmm. you have this really distinct goal of like, oh, wait, my hips were too high. That's what I'm focusing on. So you have this like mental focus that doesn't make it just feel so like this again.
Yeah. Right? Like, yeah. Absolutely. I was just talking about this morning on my stories. And you're right. A really great progressive overload strength training program is going to be quite repetitious by design, right? We have to develop proficiency in movement. And it is, you know, once we're past that novice gains phase and we're like, you know, just adding weight every week and it's like, oh my gosh, we're unstoppable. There comes a point where we start to kind of like find the intersection between our proficiency in movement and then like making small improvements in the load that we're, you know, able to push. So I think that that is a great reminder that we may not always see increases in actual load, increases in weight on the bar. And so how else do we determine that, you know, things are working, like quote unquote, what else do we choose to observe in our training? And you're right. Proficiency of movement is so, it is one of those, I think, unsung, very important, not maybe not a milestone, but like important factors that we can take a look at. The thing that makes it challenging is that it's very qualitative, right? It's not a number. So yeah. You're right in having that visual feedback from video specifically of saying like, wow, okay, like I see that my, you know, even noticing that your mobility is getting better in a particular lift, or you're able to like have more control at end range or whatever that happens to be. That's a completely valid way of gathering that data.
Yeah.
And being a really good observer of your own training and looking for that auto-regulation piece. And I think that that is tough because it takes time, right? It's, we become more experienced, we become better at those things, but also in the gathering of that information, the observation process is where we become so much richer in our own ability to sort of observe our bodies and like how the lifts are feeling and those sorts of things. And that just gives us this great language and, yeah, and sort of vocabulary to express like our own movement. And I think that that's a beautiful thing.
100%. Could not agree more. In my group programs that I do, Fitter After 40 and the Aging Stronger Society, you know, it's a group program. And one of the things I really like about a group program is that they can learn from each other. The women can learn from each other. So there are people in my group who are, who push themselves more to post their form feedback check-ins. And so then everyone can watch them. They can watch me as I, like, you know, and look, I'm always very nice. And I always start with, here's the things you did well. Like, and I can always find something they did well, right? And then here's some things you can work on. Here are some things to think about. And so even watching other people lift and read their form feedbacks can really help you. And so until you're confident enough, till you're willing to, like, push out of your comfort zone, being in a group like that can really help to see what is another woman who's at a similar stage of development with me, like similar familiarity with the barbell or with dumbbells, whatever it is, so that I can learn from them too. So that's another great way if you're listening and you're like, I'm not ready to show anybody my lifting yet. That's another option.
Yeah, totally.
Let's turn our attention and talk a little bit about nutrition and fueling our workouts. When we're talking about nutrition and timing for workouts, when is that something for people to think about that?
Hashtag it depends.
Yeah.
You know, if we think about priority in general, in terms of sports nutrition, so thinking about, like, this pyramid of priority, well, like, our number one priority is energy balance, making sure we have enough energy, right? Then we're going to be looking at things like macronutrients. From there, typically we start looking at things like timing, and then, you know, things like supplementation. So those are of diminishing importance, generally speaking. I'll say if you are working out more than once a day, for example, you have, like, a run in the morning and a lifting session in the afternoon. Now, because you're doing more activity and you've got a gap in between, you've got to be ready for the next workout, right? That kind of a constraint is going to make it more important that you're thinking about timing. If you're somebody who is, like, leading up to a competition, then probably, you know, really honing in on timing is going to be important for you. If you're working out hard in the, on the next day, you know, even, like, let's say you're doing an evening session and then the next day you have a morning session, you just have less time in between those things, just like as if you were doing two a day. So timing becomes more important there. If we're talking about general timing tips, right? Looking at, you know, for example, protein, people ask me this all the time, like, what should I do with protein? The literature, the best, like, sort of consensus we have is to spread our protein out across the day as best we can, instead of getting it all in one big lump. So that technically is kind of a timing issue. You know, people ask about post-workout, pre-workout, you know, should I eat before I work out? Should I eat after I work out? And I'll say, like, whether or not you need a dedicated meal or snack in those times depends a lot around what happened around it before and after that thing, and, like, when in the day you're training. So, it can vary. And I think that's where looking at things on a personal basis, like a one-on-one basis, can be really, really helpful. So let's say, for example, you like to work out at noontime. You had breakfast a few hours before, you know, you're going to eat again fairly soon after you get home. For you, you may not need a dedicated, you know, snack beforehand, or you know, to make sure you're eating within exactly 30 minutes. We know that the post-workout recovery window, there's a little bit more flexibility, and recovery just does not take place on, like, a 30-minute basis. It's a longer term issue. You also wouldn't want to come home and then wait 4 hours until you eat your post-workout. So, you know, for some people that post-workout is going to be their lunch. For other people, it might just be a snack and then they're going to have dinner later. That's where there's some variability. And then if we're talking about something like you're doing more endurance training, long sessions, there could be a timing element there in terms of, like, what are we doing during, that we might not do if we're strength training, just as an example. So the longer the sessions get, more endurance training we tend to do, like, that sort of thing, there's variability. So it really does depend a lot. And I'll say this, if somebody currently is just not eating enough, I want them to address the basics first. Like, maybe they come from a background where they've skipped meals intentionally or otherwise. I would want them to first work on making sure they're getting an appropriate amount of energy in their day, rather than stressing about exactly when should I eat, like, this pre-post-workout meal. So I'm always trying to rein people in and help them work on foundations first. Now, obviously, if somebody's doing a lot more training, like competing, those sorts of things, that can add some nuance to the conversation. But I think in the big picture for a lot of people, yeah. they would do a little bit better to think about like, am I getting enough protein and how do I work on that? Like, am I consistently skipping meals? What do I need to change in my day so that I at least am feeding myself on a more regular basis? So I don't end up in like a within day energy deficit sort of yeah. situation. So, yeah.
I like the idea of thinking about it in a hierarchy. And so if, you know, looking first at what are your general energy needs, what are your goals, and making sure that's met. I think it's a really human tendency when we get excited about something, when we have a goal, sure. to look at like the really sexy stuff and like the stuff people are writing articles about. And so like, oh, like nutrient timing and supplements. And really that's going to come after this other big block that maybe a person hasn't even considered about like, what are my general nutritional requirements as far as total energy? And then like, what about macronutrients? Like, am I eating a vegetable ever? Right. Mm-hmm. And like, am I anywhere getting near the amount of protein I should have in a day? And they're thinking about protein timing and really they're not even getting enough across the day. So I think that's such wise advice to like really check off those big blocks first. Like, what are your total energy needs? How is that going? What are your total protein needs? How is that going? And then if you're getting both of those, great. Like, yeah, you know, splitting it up across four meals across the day, three meals and a snack. Excellent. I know one tricky situation for a lot of people that they're just like, I don't know what to do. And I answer this question a lot is early morning workouts. You know, it's the best mm-hmm. time of day for a person to work out. They want to know like, what are some like best practices for like, I have a strength workout first mm-hmm. thing in the morning. What should I do with my nutrition? What's your,
yeah, yeah, the old fasted workouts. Yeah. You know, we used to think that fasted training would lead to like more fat oxidation throughout the day. And what we actually see is that fasted training increases fat oxidation during the workout, but then what the body does is compensates afterwards. And so uses more carbohydrate and vice versa. So I'm thinking about the intensity of the training. So I think that's important. If you're going out for a walk, like I did today, and I'm just like kind of walking along, like I'm not rucking, I'm not running, I'm just like going out for a walk. Do we need to like fuel up for that in terms of like the actual performance of what you're doing? Probably not. However, if you're going to go in and do like some heavy back squats or you're going to, it's your deadlift day, which is incredibly taxing on your body, or you're going to go do some interval training, some sprint training, like those sorts of things. And the intensity is higher. You will most likely feel better with some fuel on board. And I know there's going to be people that are like, I can't eat. Like I feel super nauseous, this and that. And some of that has to be kind of, for lack of a better term, trained in, and like mm-hmm. you need a little bit of exposure and you got to kind of keep going through it. You don't need to eat a giant meal also. Like, so that's kind of where some of the nuance comes in. But what I tend to like to see people do is have a small quantity of some kind of carbohydrate, you know, something that's relatively fast digesting is going to give you some energy for what you're doing.
What are your go-tos?
Believe it or not, something like dried mango slices. I mean, that's like very low volume and just this kind of like fruit leather, half a banana. I really like a rice cake with some jelly on it or something like that. Maybe a little bit of peanut butter. You know, we also don't want to really go into a super, super fat heavy meal because yeah. of this, the gastric emptying will slow down. Like, so your stomach will empty much slower, right before a workout, probably, you know, not going to be advantageous. So yeah, things that are quick digesting. I know other people really like Rice Krispies or like a cereal that's not super, super high in fiber, mm-hmm. those sorts of things. Some people really do like oats and they find that they tolerate that really well. So, you know, I think the end of the day, it's going to be important for each person to experiment and see what settles for their stomach the best. I know some people do really well with like a little bit of yogurt and some fruit on top, like, and they have that as a snack before they go in. So it really is going to depend, but I tend to encourage people to get somewhere in that 10 to 20 grams of carbs range, maybe a little bit of protein if they want to get that on board as well. And then, yeah, get out there, do your workout and then fuel up afterwards, whether that's your regular breakfast, cause you're home and you're going to get ready for work or you have time to eat breakfast. Just don't do the thing that most people do, which is go into their workout fasted, do their workout, get home, have to rush out the door and go to work and then not eat until after lunch or yeah. lunchtime.
They have some coffee and call it good.
A coffee is not a, coffee is not a meal, and that will go on my gravestone. And I'm fine with that because people really get triggered when I say that. And I'm like, it, they're like, but what if I put this, that, and the other in it? And I'm like, still not, you know, still not a meal. Like, even if you put a scoop of protein powder in it, we don't want protein powder to be a meal. We want it to be a supplement to the meal that potentially to the meal that we're eating or to the other meals that we're eating throughout the day. You know, because we're also potentially not getting some of the micronutrients, for example, that we would also want to see in a variety of whole protein sources as well. So, you know, we sometimes have to do what we can, like that can be an option, but yeah, coffee is not a meal. And I don't care if you get mad at me, come for me in my coffee DMs.
Not, you know what? I'm right. That's what we're going to call this episode. Coffee is not a meal. I'm writing it down right now. So I remember coffee is not a meal. If you learn nothing else from this episode. Yeah, it's true. Coffee is not a meal. Protein shake, not a meal. It's super important. Well, unless you take that protein shake and you add the berries and the fat and all those kinds of things, right?
I love both, you know, but there, you've got to be honest about what's the contribution of these things. And
yeah,
you know, if we're relying on that, because like, look, coffee's delicious. The caffeine's nice. And people who are not used to or acclimated to drinking coffee, it's like a nice, caffeine's nice ergogenic aid. For, you know, can give you performance benefits. It's wonderful. But it's that stimulant energy is not the same thing as food energy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wanted to talk just a little bit about supplements. So let's start. I do think some people, probably the most basic supplement that most women could benefit from is getting a high quality protein powder.
Yeah.
Talk about why that is and, you know, who should use it, when, why, all of that
stuff. Look, protein powder is like such a low hanging fruit. If you are looking at your protein intake, you're like, you know what? I'm strength training. I'm trying to build muscle. I know this is important. I also realize I'm pretty low in protein. And I understand that to make other changes in my day, it's one thing to go, I need more protein. And then to actually put the practices, the habits, the scheduling, everything into place, the environment that you need to have to really shift your protein intake to one that's adequate. If you're truly in an inadequate space with that, that other stuff takes effort and takes work. You know, you're thinking about how am I shopping differently? How am I food prepping differently? How am I going to potentially work in my family or someone else that lives with me? Like, how am I going to work that in too? So it can feel really daunting. So I'm like, look, even if you just add a scoop of protein powder to what you're currently doing and you change nothing else, now we're up 20, 25 grams of protein for our day. That could take you from 80 to 100 or, you know, somewhere in that range. And now you're a little bit closer to where you need to be to support the recovery, right? The muscle repair and kind of building that tissue. So it's convenient, it's easy. And I don't think we should. There are people who are like, well, it's not a whole food. Well, it's derived from food, like in terms of supplementation, you know, it's like a food product. Let's for people that are already stressed and have like no space mentally to change anything is one of the easiest things to do.
It is such low hanging fruit.
I mean, it is simple in terms of like the amount of energy and brain power required to like change a bunch of stuff. It's pretty low on the list. So that's, I think, what we want to look at and not think, well, I should just, you know, push myself to do all this meal prep. Like that's a nice thing to do. And I think meal prepping is important to some degree for most people, but that's a much bigger ask. So who can benefit from it? I mean, pretty much anyone, especially if you're really low in protein. If you're somebody who's just looking to eke up a little bit more in the protein range, like you're already doing pretty well. You just want to see what will happen if you get a little bit more, it can be super helpful as well.
Yeah. What do you suggest people look for in a protein shake? It can feel really, really overwhelming to be like, I look online at protein shakes or wherever, and it's just like, wow, there's a million choices.
There are lots
of words and advertising coming at me. Like, definitely. What should I get?
Definitely. So a couple things. We want to look for a source of protein that is complete in terms of essential amino acid content. So that's typically going to look like a whey protein or a plant protein that has a blend. Most of them will be a blend. So it'll be like pea plus rice that will give you a complete set of the essential amino acids and make sure that we have enough leucine in there to actually trigger muscle protein synthesis to actually start. From there, we can look for terms like isolate. So isolate. An isolate is going to be more purified than a concentrate and that will therefore have more protein per serving and less potential things like that could be irritants for some people, like the lactose element, for example. So when you're looking for an isolate, sometimes I'll go to the regular grocery store. You're like, wow, that protein powder is so cheap. Like, I can't believe it. And then you turn it over and it's a concentrate, which just means it has less protein per scoop than an isolate would give you. That's just something to notice. And then I think from there, it's going to depend on any other dietary like restrictions that that person has, or like foods that don't work well for you. So, if you are, like I said, lactose intolerant, if you're very, very sensitive, like you might not do well with whey protein isolate even. And so that's going to take a little bit of experimentation to see what's going to give you the biggest bang for your buck. Just know that if you use a plant-based version, you really want to make sure you look at the grams of protein per scoop on the back, because sometimes the scoop is really small. Mm-hmm. And in order to actually get the, you know, that sort of like 2.5 to 3 grams of leucine, which is, you know, we're looking at kind of over 25 grams generally for plant protein. You need 2 scoops. Mm-hmm. In some of these, in some, it just depends on the brand, but that could mean that you think you're getting like a month's supply if you're going to use one yes. serving a day, but it actually ends up being half of that. So plant proteins just tend, we need a little bit more of them to give us the amount of leucine and the amount of, you know, overall protein that we need for muscle building. So just kind of look for those things. And then of course we want to look for brands that disclose everything on the label. Mm-hmm. You know, transparency and labeling is really important. Sometimes people will say, oh, well, like it has this like proprietary blend. That must mean it's so great. But also you don't know like, how much of everything is in
that's
that,
right. It's really
that blend. And then something that's third party tested.
Excellent. Excellent suggestion.
Yeah.
Something you like the taste of, something that fits your budget. Mm-hmm. And then, notice one of the things Steph did not recommend was collagen. A lot of women want to do collagen as their protein supplementation. And it's not a complete protein, which isn't to say you can't count it at all, but you're not getting a complete protein source. And so using it as a protein supplement is really counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially if you are, you're trying to build muscle,
mm-hmm.
you are using it around the time of your workout, particularly. I mean, we do see, and I recently talked about this on a podcast that I did, you know, looking at one of the most recent systematic reviews and meta-analyses on this, like it does appear that there can be a benefit in terms of connective tissue. If we, you know, even take a little bit of collagen prior to a workout when paired with something like vitamin C for the connective tissue integrity element of that, like ligaments, tendons, et cetera, especially as we're aging, right? We mm-hmm. tend to have more stiff connective tissue, maybe a little bit more prone to connective tissue damage in that way, joint pain, et cetera. However, from the muscle building side, collagen is very low. It's incomplete, as you said, and it's also very low in the branched chain amino acids. So we need those specifically leucine to give us enough of a trigger to actually get the process of muscle protein synthesis going. Yeah. So like you said, add it as a sup, like if you want to put it in your coffee and you're like, I'm going to drink that alongside of the food that I eat around my workout, like knock yourself out. But I get a little bit worried when I hear about folks that are like, well, I can't do whey protein. And you know, it's just, I'm really busy and it's hard for me to like just have food prepared or, you know, find quick sources. And so they end up doing like 3 or 4 scoops of collagen in their day. And again, like I think part of it is to blame on the collagen supplement companies because they have used languaging and I've seen it with my own eyes. Like some of them have used languaging in the past. It's like great for, like muscle repair or great for, you know, workout recovery or things like that. And so it's really led a lot of people down that road of thinking that this is going to be beneficial for them in that context.
Yes.
Again, like the joint pain element and things like that. We do have some evidence in terms of those systematic reviews to support that claim. But at the end of the day, you know, we also want to think about variety. And if we're like doing 4 scoops of collagen and that's like a huge protein source in the day, now we're decreasing or declining even just the variety in the day. So it is rich in some of those amino acids, like that's great. But in terms of muscle building power, you're better off using something else.
Excellent recommendations there, Steph. Let's hit one more supplement before we wrap up here. Let's talk about creatine.
Oh, yay. I was hoping we were going to talk about creatine. Yeah.
All right. Kind of give us some of the same things. What is it? Who might it be for? In what cases? How do we take it? Those kinds of things.
Yeah. So creatine is something that our body naturally produces. However, we can get in the food that we eat. However, it's difficult to sort of maximize our creatine stores. Creatine is really just an energy mover in our muscles, and it is in other tissues as well, such as our brain. But in our muscles, creatine, what it does is it latches onto a phosphate group, and it can quickly donate that phosphate group back to something called ADP, which is going to form ATP, and that's going to be our muscular energy source, right? So if we want to be able to like move quickly, like push heavier weights, like have better performance, then creatine is very well documented to have those benefits. And again, we're specifically like, I'm just using the context of muscle here. There are other benefits for creatine, in terms of things like bone strength and, brain cognition, those sorts of things. So there are pretty widespread effects on the body. It's extremely well studied. Probably the most well-studied supplement. And I just talked to Dr. Darren Kandow, who is a creatine researcher in Canada. And he was telling me there are over 1,000 studies at this point on creatine monohydrate. So creatine is something we can get in some of the foods that we eat. If you do not eat a lot of animal foods, animal proteins, your creatine stores are likely to be lower. And so, it's kind of surprises people when they think about this, like, or they don't think about it and they're like, oh yeah, actually. So if I'm not eating a lot of animal protein, then I could potentially get even more benefit from using something like creatine. So we want to build up those stores in your muscles. And then when you're exercising, you're able to use that. You're able to kind of like store more of those molecules that are going to help us to then push those heavier weights, do things that are higher intensity. What were the other, I forgot the other questions you asked. So,
how should people take it?
Like, okay.
What's the plan for that?
Yeah. So, I would say for the vast majority of people, doing a creatine loading protocol, which is where you take a higher dose of creatine over a short period of time, is not necessary. Unless, I don't know, you're like, oh, I'm going to do this competition. And like, I really just want to get this loaded quickly and kind of get my intramuscular stores much higher, then you can do that kind of faster loading protocol. However, I would say for most people, a smaller dose over about a month's period of time daily is going to be a more realistic way to do it. So that would look like 3 to 5 grams a day over the course of about a month. That's going to get your intramuscular stores topped up. And then you just take it daily. Mm-hmm. And they've done some really long-term studies on a relatively like more high dose, like 10 gram a day for 2 years in postmenopausal women, and showed no adverse effects. You know, people are always concerned about it could hurt my kidneys, or this is bad for, you know, this causes baldness, or all these other creatine myths. And there was that recent kind of review that came out looking at 2 years of 10 gram a day creatine. Like, were there any notable adverse effects in postmenopausal women? The answer was no. So
did they find, I'm not familiar with this, did they find any benefit to doing that much? Because that's double the amount that most
people
are taking. Was there a benefit to that?
So there was also another study done in Canada. Recently, the results came out, although it was a study that was a long time in the making, and then took them 2 years to run the study. So again, they did a higher dose of creatine in postmenopausal women. They had them resistance training and doing walking. And they were looking at particularly the impact in bone. And would it increase bone mineral density or bone strength? So what they did not find was an increase in bone mineral density. However, they did find that certain aspects of bone strength were improved.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting to see where some of that research is going to with things like mood disruptions, which we know can certainly come on in the perimenopause transition, cognition, those sorts of things, memory. If we are sleep deprived, which can of course happen in perimenopause as well, like you start sleeping less, like less sleep, sleep quality declines for some people. Is there a benefit there? So it's super interesting how that stuff is playing out. And I think that in the past, creatine has had a reputation, if you will, of being like, oh, this is just for like gym bros or people that are, you know, meatheads and that sort of thing. And the research on women has been super, super interesting in that way. Like, it's a great question, you know, how do women respond to creatine? We tend to have smaller stores of creatine as it is. So, you know, there's some benefit there just by supplementing. And if women are eating lower quantities of protein and getting less creatine in the food that they're eating, how can we see a benefit there? So there was a paper that was done by Abby Smith Ryan, and they looked at creatine across the lifespan in women and how there were different, you know, different benefits and what we saw there. So yeah, I would say for most people that slower loading protocol or slower accumulation protocol is plenty helpful. They don't need to, you know, do the super high dose over like 5 to 7 days. It's generally not necessary. And for people that feel like maybe they're a little bit more sensitive, even splitting that dose up, that 3 to 5 grams across the day. So maybe you take it in 2 servings and just go from there.
Awesome. Thanks, Steph. Let's wrap up here. My favorite question I always like to end with, I like to give the women who are listening just kind of like a flavor for how other women are training and what's getting them excited. Mm-hmm. So what are you psyched about when it comes to moving your body these days?
Oh, great question. So currently I am training for a GORUCK challenge, and that will be in the fall. I haven't exactly decided which. There's 2 options that I have, but this is going to be like a 12-hour event. And it's usually a team event. So there's team stuff going on, but basically wear a ruck, so a weighted backpack, and there's all kinds of other stuff involved, like sandbag work and all kinds of stuff. So that 12-hour event is kind of like on my horizon this fall. So that's what I'm doing. I started running again this year as well, so that I can actually run in these events.
Because never heard of a Go Ruck challenge in my life. That sounds very exciting.
Yeah, they have different lengths. The one that we did over Memorial Day was a 3-hour event, and they have them all the way up through 24 hours. And then there's a very special one that they do, and that's a 2-day. That's outside my wheelhouse. That's like a
2-day.
That's a very hardcore event, but. Yeah. So I started running again and welcomed running back into my life in February. And I hadn't run for, yeah, like purposely run for probably 12 years.
Wow.
And it's something that when I was doing triathlons, and prior to that was running, you know, half marathons and stuff, running, I always kind of associated with just like trying to be as skinny as possible and really just got burnt out from all of that. And didn't love that association anymore and kind of was like, I'm just not a runner. Like, I don't enjoy it. And, when I kind of reframed that in my mind this year, and I was like, you know, I really want to be able to do some of these events. And I know that there's going to be some running involved. Like, now it feels good. It feels good to like, want to build that part of my fitness again. So I've been running for that reason as well. And, I get a lot of people who are like, well, should I start running too? And I'm like, I mean, let's hold on. Like, not necessarily if you wanted to. Yeah, of course. But don't feel like just because somebody you follow is training in a particular way that you have to do it. If you feel inspired, great. Like, that's wonderful. But, you know, when it comes to cardio, there's so many options that you have.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's an event that I'm training for in the fall. I still do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I'm a brown belt in BJJ now, which is hard to believe. It's been,
what are the belt levels? So we know where you're at. Where's brown?
Okay. So white, blue, purple, brown, black.
Wow. So,
yeah. One below there. A black belt. And then, I lift weights, you know, I lift weights a few times a week. So
tell us what your return to running looked like. So it's been 12 years.
It was 12 years. Yeah.
How did you ease yourself back in?
I did basically a Couch to 5K program. It's not actually the Couch to 5K app, but it was a similar one.
Okay.
Where over the course of 6 weeks, it was three times a week, and it just starts with intervals, you know, run, walk, run, walk, run, walk. And over the course of the 6 weeks, you know, gradually the running time increased and the walking time decreased. And at times there'd be like, you know, there's rest actually in between. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, those things started to like all compress. And the end of the 6 weeks was to run 5K. And I honestly truly like hand on heart, when I started the program, I was like, I don't even know if I could run a half an hour because I'm like a 31 minute, like 5K. I'm not a very fast runner. So I was like, you know, I just want to run it without stopping. I'm like, I'm not actually all that sure I can do that.
Yeah.
So I had to get used to it again. I've been practicing for a while now, like breathing more through my nose while I'm exercising. So I was able to kind of see the benefits of that. I never thought I'd be able to run and do it with my mouth closed ever. And then I'm able to do that now. So, you know, to your point, like looking at other metrics of improvement and those sorts of things. So yeah, I just kind of got to that 5K at the end of that 6 weeks. And now I run about 3 miles a few times a week. Most of the time it's real slow. You know, it's like zone 2. Everybody's like base building zone 2 that they all hate. You're going so slow, but, so that's what I do now. I don't do anything super long distance or anything, but it's just a nice way to get out. And I really do enjoy the feeling of being out there again, I think is nice. It's nice to feel that way again.
That's exciting stuff. Thank you for sharing with us. And thank you for coming on and having this whole conversation. I think that the listeners are going to benefit so much from just a variety of topics. So thank you for your time. Tell everyone where they can connect with you.
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram is primarily where I'm active at Steph_Godreau. My website. I know, right? So it's Steph_Godreau, Godreau. And then my website, stephgodreau.com. And then the Fuel Your Strength podcast.
Awesome. This has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Fitness Simplified podcast. I hope you found it motivational, inspirational, educational, organizational. If you did find value in this episode today, it would mean a great deal to me if you would leave a rating and review on whatever podcasting platform you are listening to this episode on. It really does help to get this podcast in front of other people. Thanks so much for being here.